Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus.
Makalua.
The main team.
Mega Bears fan.
Did he step away? No, there he is.
No, I'm here. Okay. Welcome to Polycast episode 437 with the always attentive main team, also joined by Canis Albinus.
Too many Rayquazas today.
Makalua?
I think everybody needs coffee this morning, apparently.
And Mega Bears fan.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't stay up till 1:30 playing football.
Do it.
Is it the right football or the wrong football?
Yes.
You could stay up watching it.
Yeah, I think 1:30 is 1:30, regardless of whether you're playing or watching.
But then you can have a couch nap.
I could, yeah. All right, well. We have big news. Finally, things are starting to get rolling. So according to our new CM, community manager, FXS underscore SAR, or I guess we can call her Sarah or SAR, we are going to have a gameplay showcase for Civilization 7 and a gameplay reveal trailer and a showcase on August 20th, which is in like... what, 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Yep. At says here 11, says 11 a.m. Pacific time. 20-minute gameplay preview. 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, and then they're going to be showing off the game at GamesCon, which is going on that later that week from August 21st to 25th. So if you will be at GamesCon, you will have a chance potentially to. See Civ 7. I don't know if it will be playable or not.
I doubt it.
But so you might not have a chance to play it, but you will have a chance to see it and potentially see more than what we will see in the preceding gameplay trailers and deep dives. And then there will be a developer panel with Kinda Funny Games' Greg Miller at PAX West on August 31st at 11 a.m. Pacific time. So, yeah, I mean, like... this is really starting to feel real now.
Yeah, considering they've got 3 more weeks and they're already at a point where they have a playable game, I don't know, they might actually have it available to demo at one of the two.
I guess we'll find out.
Possible. Also,
hard to say.
For those who are not aware, which I think is everybody, or I think everybody knows this by this point, but GamesCon is in Germany, so it's not particularly accessible to those of us in America, but the internet exists, and that should be fine.
Oh, yeah, it's got to do a VR thing.
Yeah, there'll be plenty of the European players who would be able to go to that, and I'm sure there will be reports when the Euro gaming sites.
And then PAX West is in Seattle, which it still amazes me that they hold PAX West in the summer and PAX East in the winter, because PAX East is in Boston in February. And anybody who's ever been to Boston in February will tell you, not a fun time to be there. Whereas in the winter in Seattle, it's not great, but it's not anywhere near as bad.
Yeah, it's not the land of ice and snow.
Right.
And summers are getting pretty bad along the entire West Coast these past few years. I mean, we've had, Seattle and Oregon getting heat waves as bad as what we get in Vegas and Texas.
Yeah. And then everything's not set up for that kind of temperatures over there.
Yeah, those poor bastards, a lot of them don't even have air conditioning.
Yeah.
So hopefully it is not miserable in Seattle on August 31st.
Just use a RimWorld passive cooler.
Or on fire.
I'll be honest, it's Seattle. They get good weather and mostly not hot weather all the time. So when they get a little bit of heat, I don't feel sorry for them.
I think when I usually hear about heat waves in the Pacific Northwest, it's usually like Portland. That's the place that's suffering, not Seattle.
Well, Portland is suffering for a number of reasons right now. But the weather is... usually pretty good there.
Yeah, but when it is 110 degrees and you don't have an air conditioner, that is pretty miserable.
Very true.
Yeah.
And potentially deadly. Yeah, potentially deadly. So
It really is a shame that they don't work like that. The passive coolers in reality are not as good as they are in RimWorld, to put it mildly.
I know.
Those things are incredible in RimWorld. I'd love to have that.
I mean, a passive cooler sounds awesome. Does that cost as much on your electricity bill as an actual air conditioning does? Because
No. In RimWorld, they're pretty electronic. You're just building that out of wood.
It's almost like a swamp cooler type of a thing. And it's like, but how?
But unlike reality, there's no like cap on humidity for the cooling effect or anything. You just put it in there and it takes you down to like room temperature-ish.
Yeah, well, the $400 to $500 a month electricity bill for air conditioning is pretty brutal. And we can't really do swamp coolers here either because of water shortages. So
if it works like that, they would be everywhere in the world. If they worked like RimWorld. Sure. Same thing with solar. If solar is good in reality as it was in RimWorld, my gosh, they would be using nothing but solar.
If you could just make an air conditioner out of wood, yeah, sure, that would be great.
Yeah.
Remember that this is multi-thousands of years in the future, so they're
like alien wood.
I don't think the laws of physics change in that time frame.
Well, it's like any like crafting survival game. Like you build like an entire shelter out of like two sticks and like a leaf, which you somehow turn into rope, so...
Unless it's Elden Ring, then you can't have rope until the DLC get wrecked.
I guess we won't be building any tents in Elden Ring then.
Nope. Only destroying them.
By rolling on top of them.
Of course.
Yep.
Which is the optimal way to destroy anything, of course.
Roll on top of it.
I mean, to be fair, I think if I'd like dolphin dove into a tent and then did a rolling move, it would probably damage the tent pretty significantly. Unless the tent is, like, massive. It's like one of those circus tents. Then I would just look like an idiot as I like, bounce off it.
Also, I am impressed by anybody who can physically perform a FromSoft roll. Because it is a pretty acrobatic move.
Yeah.
Regardless of what you're wearing,
plate armor, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're wearing 100 pounds of armor on top of it, that would be, I mean, you'd be, like, the best athlete in the history of everything.
Yeah, I think relative to some of their other feats, it's not as impressive, though, just because they're so friggin' strong generally.
I mean, I remember the meme of the person who, like, went to, like, Comic-Con or something. This was years ago, dressed up as Solaire, and just, you know, would pull out his sword and, you know, be, like, on guard. And then when the other cosplayers would pull out their weapons or whatever, then he would just start rolling circles around them. And it was funny, and it was good, but, like, dude definitely could not do an actual Dark Souls roll, because, like, nobody can.
I'm telling you, though, if you had Dark Souls strength, like you could squat 2,000 pounds in sets, you could probably do those rolls pretty easily, even in armor.
Yeah, probably.
So our next topic is the continuation of the Study of the Past series retrospective that... Somebody just breathed into the mic. That we had of previous games and the things they added. So this week we've got Civilization 4, 5, and 6. And I was a little bit perturbed by the Civ 5 one because there were only four things listed and one of them was a meme. Apparently the biggest thing in Civ 5 that was the biggest innovation according to Firaxis was the trading argument with England meme.
Ugh, which I love that meme, but come on. No.
That's not the biggest thing the game added. But let's go back to Civ 4 real quick. So the things they added... The things they added in Civilization 4 were full 3D visuals, great people, a religion system that was influential on gameplay, and Baba Yetu.
Grammy Award-winning Baba Yetu.
Winning the first Grammy Award won by any game made for a video game.
It was a little bit influential.
Just a little.
You want to be my vassal?
And then the other things they mentioned for Civ 5 are the hex map, leaders speaking their own language, parenthetical, or something close to it, because some of those leaders we don't actually know what they spoke, so you just give going by what you can find.
Well, and some of those languages are also like dead languages, which are really hard to find people who can actually speak them.
What language exactly did Attila the Hun speak? We don't really know, and also there's no way to really find out. Need a time machine for that. And then the other thing is great works and archaeology were added in Civ 5. Now, I didn't take a whole lot of time to sit and think about what innovations were added in Civ 5 in response to this, but pretty sure there was more than that.
The standing army tax.
Persistent governments, perhaps?
Well, we had city-states.
City-states, I would say, are the big deal.
That would be, I think, one of, if not the biggest. Because even the hex grid, you know, that might not be permanent, but I highly doubt that we will ever see a 4X, you know, grand strategy game that doesn't have city-states or some or minor factions or something like it ever again.
Well, yeah. At least not in Civ.
Also, yeah, it was the World Congress.
Yeah, which we still have in 6, and you make more... I think I like the decisions we get in 6 a bit better, although there's still definitely room for improvement. Well, but the fact that it affects the whole game and for all the players, you know, it's not just a...
I don't know. I feel like the proto-World Conquest, World Congress, not World Conquest, was the UN in Civ 4.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think Civ 5 just kind of made it bigger and better.
Yeah, it expanded on the concept.
Palace, yeah.
And yeah, we don't have the Apostolic Palace.
You don't need the Apostolic Palace.
Well, but it was such a griefing tool. How can you not have a griefing tool in the game? Amazing.
What are you saying, Mackie?
But my early wins. I mean, it was because it's one of the few ways you could actually win the game when you'd actually, you know, won the game. Which is what we've talked about a number of times about how the later game drags because you're trying to fulfill a win condition, even though in practical sense, you've won.
By far the easiest way to win high difficulties without the skill to win them otherwise.
Yeah.
And then we get Civ 6. And Civ 6 is like, oh, hey, we got districts, civic tree, religious victory, 2 expansions and 2 passes, which pretty sure almost all previous Civ games also had 2 expansions, but, you know.
Yeah.
And some version
of listing that over the policy cards?
Yeah, you're very customizable government. You can you just go in there and spend, what, between 50 and 100 gold, depending on the era. Boom, change your government around from a war footing to a more diplomacy or a science. Or, yeah, I really like the policy cards and how it lets you change the government. You're not locked into things the way we used to with the other type that we've done before.
There's a lot of planning and timing in that system.
And then they say, great ages, I would give them that. Loyalty? Happened in Civ 4 with city flipping.
Yeah, with culture.
Yep, governors are pretty new. Environmental effects are not new. They've been in, you know, Civ 4 before. Gotta love those random events.
I think even earlier, they had...
If you want to count the early global warming, which started desertifying everything.
Yeah. I feel like there was like already some of that stuff going on, like Civ 2.
In defiance of how global warming would work, yeah.
Yeah, well... None of the Civs have accurately represented global warming. It's a game mechanic through and through.
I think it's worth giving them credit, though, for systemizing that stuff as opposed to just being, like, completely random screw-you dice rolls.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there's perceivable consequence to your actions that influence those sorts of things, except for, like, you know, like some of the, like, flooding and stuff like that that was pretty random. But, I mean, hey, you settled near a floodplain, so...
I'm going to tell you, having played Civilization VI quite a bit, the environmental effects are rarely the result of my actions because I don't build coal and oil factories. And as a result, I don't have a lot of control over who does and how much carbon gets added to the atmosphere. So all the global warming things happen to me without my actual intervention.
Fair point. So
Civ 4 was poorly documented. Like, there was a lot of mechanics that went into when global warming started, and the desertification being random wasn't great. But there, like, how many trees you cut down, and the amount of pollution that was being done in the world, and the type of power you're generating, all of that had an influence on global warming. They just didn't, like, put it together, like you're saying, with later Civs, where you would have, like, reasonably predictable events from that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll rephrase a little bit. It's not necessarily the result of things that you do, but rather the result of the things that the agents within the game do, whether it's players or AIs. And, you know, the important thing being that the system is, you know, is predictable to a large degree, as opposed to, like I said before, just being completely random dice rolls.
Yeah, we even have some of the tiles marked on the map. It's like, yeah, you can build here, but it's going to get flooded if you don't watch global warming.
Yeah.
And it's there from the start of the game.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing where, like, I don't imagine ever seeing random events the way we saw them in Civ 4 again, because Gathering Storm are far better.
Agreed.
has decided yeah, I don't miss events in Sephora. Category 5 hurricane hits you. Yeah, thanks, game.
I usually just turn them off anyway.
Yeah.
In Sephora.
Yeah, I remember you having a rage about that one time in a game when we were playing. It's like, yeah, nobody disagreed. Yeah.
There was some stuff that was just like, it could be game breaking if it you got some of the really low odds, like things happening at a bad time.
Yeah. And to me, that is for me, at least, what would define a game feature being like, you know, innovative or, you know, having like a legacy is if this feature comes along and the ways that games in that series or in general used to do things, if they stop doing it that way and they start doing it the new way, that's I think a truly innovative feature. So I do think that warrants inclusion.
And then they put World Congress as part of Civ 6, even though it's been in. And it's not even effectively different than it was in Civ 5. It's just earlier.
But yet still also feeling like a strict downgrade.
Yeah.
I don't know about strict, but there's some trade-offs that I liked 5 more.
They list the information age, which that was in Civ 5 as well. Game modes, which if you've ever seen Civ 3 and all the different various game modes you had in that, talking about you regicide, for example, that
you had like barbarian mode in Civ 4 too.
Yeah,
game modes aren't new.
And then personas, which are just glorified alternate leaders, really.
Wait, even Civ 2 shipped with some game modes.
Yeah,
I remember playing like XCOM, but in Civ and stuff.
Well, I mean, all the games have had scenarios.
Yeah.
So that's definitely been there all along, except maybe for Civ 1 might not have.
I don't think Civ 1 did, but I know that everything after it did, except vanilla Civ 6 didn't have any.
I mean, even just checking the Raging Barbarians checkbox in the settings is arguably a game mode.
Yep. And we don't even have that in Civ 6, so... My guess is they're just putting all this stuff in Civ 6 so people will go and buy Civ 6 while it's still relevant.
It was on a pretty steep sale, I think, a few weeks ago. One of my friends at work bought it.
Yep. It goes on steep sale all the time right now, and has for the last few years.
Yeah, it was the summer sale, Steam summer sale.
Should we move on to the next topic?
Yeah, we'll talk about Yongle. Because apparently that's our current challenge of the month. I keep wanting to call it game of the month, but no, that's not right.
That's a Civ pretty close thing.
I know, my brain. Ah, yes.
But it's a similar concept.
Yongle also, into space.
Before we go any further, we have to remind people that it's not Yongle, it's Yongle.
Oh, well.
I'm
sure my brain's
one of
totally
the posters is saying
that.
It's Yongle.
That
so now we have
right
all kinds
too.
Of different pronunciations going around.
Cough, cough. The Chinese don't have an alphabet. Cough. Hard to do it.
Anyway, however his name is pronounced, that is our challenge of the month. We're basically doing Yongle into space, even though he's more of a cultural type of guy and everything. I haven't had a chance to start playing it. I think Candace has.
I have, and it's not just a Yongle into space. It's also Yongle into culture. So
yeah, culture's allowed.
Yeah, you basically do one or the other, and there's supposed to be some kind of, like, social media reference to which of the two versions is winning. And, like, I don't know exactly what that was about, but they said they were supposed to be doing it in such a way that you could look on social media and find out which team, culture, or science was better. But as for the game itself, it's a tiny map. Fractal map type, and there's four other Yongles on the map with you. So it's you and three other guys who are exactly the same as you doing the exact same thing.
We're back to which color Inca are you?
Yeah, I think this is something about it being related to the Yongle meme that's about selfies, maybe? I don't actually know. But I played the game. It was enjoyable, although it was a very generic challenge. I mean, how many times have you done a culture and a science victory? There's no real special requirements for this, except that you can't kill everyone and win that way, or diplomacy yourself out.
The Dongle Yongle demands blood.
I'm trying to remember because I did this when it first happened, and that was more than 3 weeks ago. So I'm trying to remember if anything unique actually happened in the game. But I think it was just they were all fairly aggressive when I started building wonders. So
yeah, as the rest of us did not have a chance. Wait, I don't think we have much more to say on that for the time being.
It's not a particularly interesting challenge, really. It's just win by your choice, and we'll add up everyone who wins at the end of the challenge, I guess.
Someone needs to find a way to win a victory that's not allowed in it, and then the community needs to spam that one.
The community doesn't care about what we think is funny.
That's okay. We'll make them do it anyway, somehow.
Well, you could kill two out of the other... You could kill all but one of the other Yongles, and then, you know, you could just... And sit there with all those extra cities and do it really fast. I mean, not preventing you from going to war for that.
Yeah.
You can kill all three of them. The game just won't end until you get to the culture or science victories.
Can you win culture if you kill everyone? Wouldn't you have to do space then?
Actually, now that I think about it, I think if you kill everyone, you automatically win culture.
Oh, nice. Oh,
so we can't do it the normal way. All right.
All right, so there's a correct victory condition. Got it. It's just you have to take all the cities rather than just capitals. Fair enough. None of this newfangled BS conquest. We're doing the real conquest where there's no other civs in existence.
There can be only one.
Bring back the You Got Served references with loyalty flipping cities.
Oh my goodness.
Been a while.
Time to talk about navies?
As in,
oh, I guess. Does the AI ever build a great navy by Planetfall? No, it doesn't. Okay.
I was going to say, this sounds like a short topic to me.
No, I don't think I've ever seen a significant AI navy.
Use some things for defense occasionally. And every once in a while they'll bring something to bombard, but comparatively to the how the humans do it, yeah, not really.
Yeah, it makes boats. Like, this isn't like the naval carpeting you could get in Civ 5 or like stacks of 150 to 200 plus ships on high difficulties in Civ 4.
My experience in Civ 6 is that some of the AIs will start to build a navy very early in the game, but then they just kind of stop building them. And if all their ships get sunk early, they do not build new ships to replace them, which is kind of an issue with Civ 6's like military unit construction logic in general. I noticed this recurring trend in Civ 6 where if a particular faction's, you know, AI faction's military gets like wiped early in the game, they never build new units to replace them until maybe like very late when a bunch of like new types of unit lines come into play,
right,
where they're not upgrading previous units, they're building new units, and then you just have a unit that has like nothing but AA guns.
I do know that Brazil builds a lot of battleships because that's their unique unit and they're flavored to do that. And Norway will also do the same thing.
Yeah, although Norway will have the problem that I mentioned earlier, where they'll build a handful of their longboats, and then they'll get sunk. And then they don't build any more ships to replace them.
Boris Goodenough is pointing out, you post down in here about the fleets he's seen in Civ is the barbarian fleets. And like, yes, if you have a couple of camps that are not close enough for you to get to and they have the chance, they will spawn giant fleets of ships. I have seen this.
Oh, yeah. There will be plenty of barbarian caravels out there, which is why I always, you know, evangelize for the privateer unit in Civ 6, because you just have a couple of those, two or three privateer units, you can go and wipe out all those barbarian caravels and then use the coastal raid ability to take their outpost and just get a butt ton of free gold from it.
Even early game, though, they'll still do it with quadrines and galleys, and goodness help you if one of them's got a specialty ship, like they can make the Viking longships. I've seen the Byrenes as well.
Yeah, the barbarians will absolutely raise any city on the coast if you build it early enough.
So the question is, why can't the regular AI do that?
I think it's just a flavor thing. They just don't have the flavor to. And again, in general, it's with military units. Like I think my guess is that the way that the AIs are programmed is they prioritize building units very early in the game to defend themselves, and then have very low or no priority for building units in like the medieval Renaissance, early industrial era. And so they just don't. So if they lose those units that they built earlier, they don't bother replacing them. They will upgrade their units that still exist if they're still on the map, but they just don't build new ones.
We have a report from Miserable Old Git, who says, playing on huge splintered fractal maps, every game the AI spawns at least one or two massive navies, as in navies big enough to actually kill GDRs.
Wow. That I've never seen, but I've never played on huge maps either.
Well, there you go. And I remember as well, like when Civ 6 first came out, like the AIs would never build air units. And like, I think they had to fix that in a patch. So, and I wonder if that's a similar problem and they just never fixed it for navies.
Yeah, because I think even now the AI is still not the greatest with the air units. I mean, they'll build them and they'll actually use them now, but it's still like with the navies compared to what a human player would do with that.
Except, ironically, they've always loved AA guns.
Yeah, I know.
And Civ 6, there will be carpets of AA guns, but there will not be a single plane in sight.
Well, yeah. That might be a self-defeating or self-fulfilling prophecy, because if the AIs have big fleets of, you know, AA guns, and then they go to war with each other, if they have airplanes or not, they're going to be gone. So
sure, but the AA guns are there weren't planes to begin with, and then there are just AA guns all over the place. So, I mean, sure, I guess you could make the argument that yeah, why build planes if they're just going to get shot down by AA guns, but.
Planes aren't allowed in this world. Everyone goes AA.
I think This is another one of those issues that comes up a lot where, because of the way they test the game, it seems like they are missing some key points where the AI doesn't work properly. Because they talk about how, or they talked about in a GDC conference once or in other places over time, where what they do is they'll have a computer just like they put all the AIs together in a simulation and just let them run like multiple games overnight while they're at home. And they come back and look at the overall performance and say, okay, so the AI, some AIs are doing better than others on this statistical level. And they change things based on that. And that can cause problems because they're not looking specifically at what each AI does and how it results that way. They'll just buff up the units a little bit. And I know there are a lot of things that can happen that this game does suffer from that can be part of that particular testing cycle. Not that it's a necessarily bad cycle, but you gotta do other types of testing too, or else you're gonna miss big things like, oh hey, the AI doesn't build units for their navy enough, or they don't build new units after the classical era or stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think fundamentally, like, you know, why do you build land armies, right? You build land armies because the other civs have land armies and you need to protect yourself. So one of the soapboxes that I've been on for a long time is one of the things that I think will improve the way that navies work in Civ across the board is if they bring back, you know, some kind of piracy mechanics, like the hidden nationality of privateers that was in Civ 4 and colonization, and make those units available earlier, like having like a medieval corsair unit or a classical corsair unit, late classical, that has hidden nationality, because now you have basically barbarians with an agenda, and then you have to build a navy in order to defend yourself.
Right.
And then once one player has a navy, then the other players are going to be like, oh, your naval strength is very high. You are a threat. We have to build a navy in response.
And then they all sink to cities in artillery fire.
Well, that's possible, but it's not always going to happen, right?
Probably not. Well, with AI, you never know. The AI might reliably suicide its ships at first.
So yes, please bring back privateers with hidden nationality. Pretty please.
Oh, you know what the next Civ game needs? It needs the Hearts of Iron 4 naval invasion sound.
Oh no.
Amazing.
I don't know how this is going to work, but give me a second.
Oh. Soundboard time.
Oh yeah.
I barely heard it. Did you guys
every
hear
few
it?
Seconds in Hearts
it.
Of Iron?
Yeah,
AI is trying that crap somewhere.
There we go. I turned up the soundboard so the stream could hear it.
The best part about it is that most of the time nothing happens when you hear that. But then every once in a while there's an actual naval landing somewhere that's like could be really crippling if you don't do something about that, because they'll get a beachhead and open up a new line against you.
And usually you have very few units on that line.
Yeah, so you can lose a lot of ground and get into a lot of trouble quickly if you're not really careful. I've seen people rage quit over it.
I've rage quit over it.
I didn't get the chance to rage quit over it once because I just died. But most of the time I just garrison parts differently than the game does by default, and I'm fine.
Yeah, it turns out if you have a single victory point and you lose it to a naval invasion, if you're not watching, you just lose instantly.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of hard to quit early that way when you've already lost.
We should talk about Civ 7 now.
That's true. Well, that's, yeah, I'm saying Civ 7 should include that.
No.
Everyone would enjoy it.
Okay, well, that sounded like a cue to do the next topic, which is a poll on Civ Fanatics asking whether we prefer one unit per tile, Carpets of Doom, or Stacks of Doom. So be sure to log in and vote on your preference. Right now, it looks like Carpet of Doom is winning 53 votes to 44 votes against Stacks of Doom, and then there is a halfway option, which is in a close third place with 41 votes. So I'm actually kind of surprised by that result. I thought Carpet of Doom would be the overwhelming victor, even though I personally prefer being able to stack just because it makes things easier and more convenient to move across the board. But I thought that the fan base in general much preferred the one unit per tile. So I thought Carpet of Doom would run away with this one. But...
Well, we haven't had true one unit per tile in many years now.
True.
Yeah,
that was like early Civ 5 stuff.
We should also point out that Carpet of Doom is a thing that only exists in famous Civ 4 player Sulla's mind, because the idea of the Carpet of Doom as a massive carpet that cannot be moved through was only a thing that occurred in the screenshot he took when he was reviewing Civ 5 when it first came out.
High difficulty Civ 5 early on would produce that pretty often.
I saw it in both Civ 5 and Civ 6. Yeah, at higher difficulty levels, you know, like Emperor and above, it would happen in Civ 5 where, like, city-states in particular would have a unit on every single tile that the city-state owned, and they would not be able to move. And some countries, some AI players would have, 20 units, and it wouldn't necessarily be every single tile, but like to the point where trying to move them, you know, off the front line, like into enemy territory, would be problematic. And then in Civ 6, I haven't seen carpets like that, with the exception of when vanilla Civ 6 came out, there were Spanish missionaries.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And that was before religious units were on their own lair. And those and those blocked movement. So there was the Spanish missionary Carpet of Doom that was a problem in launch Civ 6.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't remember anything in Civ 6 that was anywhere near as bad as early Civ 5, but I mentally blocked out the early Civ 6 missionaries.
I'm sorry to refresh all that trauma in everybody's memory.
I mean, I just saw it as an act of war. Like, okay, well, if you're going to deny me military access in my own territory, I have a solution for this.
Well, that was what you had to do, because that was the only thing you could do at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you had an Inquisitor, but like your Inquisitors weren't beating 50 Spanish missionaries. They just weren't.
No, it's your military code for sure.
Your military code for sure, yeah. And it was always Spanish. Always Spanish missionaries.
Yeah, something to Spain's flavor just encourages that.
Yeah, just massive, massive spamming of missionaries.
Yeah, I think we're going to wind up with some kind of mix.
I don't want them to go the millennia route, because that was annoying.
And I think that's just, it's also the direction the genre is going. It's the direction millennia went. It's the direction humankind went. So I think that's just the future of of the genre. I don't know what Aura is going to do, but probably some kind of hybrid thing as well. I don't even, is Aura even going to have hexes?
I think it does, or maybe it's squares, but either way,
yeah,
it's hard to tell based on what we know.
I don't recall seeing a grid on any of the Aura screenshots at all, so I have no idea what they're using under the hood. When does that game come out? Later this year or next year as well?
I think it's later this year. Oh my gosh.
Someone's advocating semi-permanent army out of the stacks. Organizes similar to Total War or HOM. Ha ha. Be amazing.
No, that would not be good in a Civ game.
I didn't say it would be good, but it would be amazing. A different kind of amazing.
Troll-a-la-la-lol amazing?
It would just bog the game so much because of the differences in scope. If he just means like the unit portraits and movement, then actually that's reasonable. Because like Heroes of Might and Magic, like you wouldn't be able to copy their tactical combat into Civ and have it run cleanly. That would be a nightmare. But if you just mean like you have this many slots that can go into an army, and like you have to pick your unit types or whatever to fit those slots, and you can only fit so many per area. Okay, that actually would work.
Well, and that's again pretty much how humankind does it. And yeah, there's like technologies that you research that increase the capacity of your armies.
And of course, HOM itself is varied a little bit game to game.
I would kind of like to be able to like kind of decommission my, not like permanently disband them, but like put them in cities and garrisons and have them just kind of like disappear from the map. And if they could even do something useful, like, I don't know, do like training or something like that, or increase the productivity of the cities or something like that while they're there, that would be nice.
Be maybe too heavy of a buff to military units to have them like be productive, but having them just like disappear and then come back when you need them, that would be a nice quality of life.
Or maybe not having to pay the maintenance cost when they're like, you know, just garrisoned in a city or whatever.
That would not work.
And have them disappear.
I mean, you already have like some mechanism for that in some of the games where you pay more when they're outside your borders than inside. But it's like, I don't want to, even as a military player, I don't want to make military the only thing you build. And those types of changes would push it towards that direction. By itself, it wouldn't make it the only thing you make. But yeah, if you're getting more productivity out of that, or you're not paying for it, then you have much more incentive to just make ridiculous army sizes and then get a tangible economic benefit from them. Then you hit some breakpoint, you pull all those out, and now you just go mop a significant chunk of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it would depend on whether the investment in building the units is, you know, surpassed by their productivity. So,
sure, but I mean ultimately, those units still have another use, which is to go knock some heads. So yeah, any benefit that you're getting during the buildup phase, in addition to doing their ability to do that, is just a straight up buff, unless you nerf them otherwise.
I'm just saying something that takes them off the map when they're not being used.
Oh, for quality. Yeah, I mean, that part of it, I agree with. That'd be really nice quality of life. You don't have to give them any special stuff beyond that. Just the ability to do that, to like make it less painful to manage, would be appreciated.
Yeah, even if it's... Oh, go ahead.
Also, so like if you have an encampment in your city, maybe you can park the army at the encampment and they have like reduced maintenance while they're in the encampment.
Even if it's just something as simple as they're allowed to stack when they're garrisoned in cities, but they can't fight when they're stacked. And they can stack when they move on roads and railroads. So I can move my entire army at once, you know, but they can't fight when they're stacked. Like, even something like that, I would appreciate. Of course, the AIs would have to know how to do that, but
yeah, I was just gonna say that's some AI bait right there.
That's a different story, but yeah, just something that collapses those carpets or makes them disappear so that they're easier to move with fewer clicks. Because again, I bring this up all the time, is one of the most frustrating things about fighting wars, right? Especially when you start getting into, you know, intercontinental wars in Civ 5 and Civ 6, is you win one war, and then your next war is clear across the map. And then you got to move all your units. And in Civ 6 in particular, you got to do it like one turn at a time, because if you try to just tell them all to move 10 turns worth of moves to the other side of the map, like they get all hung up and then they cancel their moves, or they turn around and go a different direction because something is standing on a tile that they're supposed to move to or move through. And it's just like, oh my God, I really have to do this one turn at a time, move all 20 friggin' units. Like, come on, there's gotta be a better way.
Some of that is just inexcusably bad implementation, though. Like, even in the current system, the way that interacts is, I think, inexcusable. Like, it's just, there's no reason for it to be that bad, but it is that bad. And that's been one of my gripes with the series ever since we've gone to one unit per tile. And yeah, I would absolutely love to see that movement be less tedious, one way or another.
Yeah, and again, I liked Humankind's system. I don't know how the general community reacted to it, but basically you stack your units into an army, and then when they meet other armies in the field, you deploy them, and then it goes to one unit per tile. And I liked that a lot. It was way easier to manage large armies in that game compared to Civ 5 or Civ 6. And also you got multiple rounds of combat in a single round of, like, the, you know, main game, which, you know, sped up wars as well. So you didn't have one war that lasted for like 1,000 years the way it will often happen in Civ.
Okay, time for the next hybrid war setup. So you have like a Civ map that's procedurally generated. However, you also procedurally generate the entire front lines of both Civs and deploy all the units. Like Bannerlord. I'm kidding. It'd be cool if you could do it. I don't think you could do it. I don't think machines could handle it.
There was that reminds me of how the Civilization: A New Dawn board game kind of works, where you don't really have like units or armies. You just kind of project force, you know, adjacent to your borders, and then, you know, have like competing dice rolls or whatever to determine who takes control over that particular hex.
No, we're going straight to real time. The game just generates the battlefield based on the actual composition of the civs, and then you have to micro the units. Nobody would play this. I would play it, but most people wouldn't play it. You wouldn't be able to sell that game, even though it's a cool idea. But it strains too many different styles of game, and it would be hard to make it good. Really hard to make it good.
Lost the topic list.
top 7 choices for uniqueness.
Yep, there it is. Okay, so this is a thread done by Lazy Sweeper again. And he was trying to come up with unique units that are underrepresented in the history of Civ, and, you know, he wants to see them. So he lists monk warriors from Tibet and Amazonian jungle warriors and the Finns, who are berserkers with double axe, single hammer, and pike. I thought this was an interesting thread, mostly because of the sheer amount of ideas for unique units that would be great in countries that already exist. Like camel javelinier is mentioned in the second post. Quadarites.
T-34 tank.
Yeah.
That's funny.
It was pretty effective back in the old days, but it's not so effective now.
I mean, it was a tank they had. I don't know if that was nearly good enough for it to be considered a unique unit tank.
I don't think so. It was mass-produced and everyone in the world uses it. That's not in the U.S. orbit.
Its performance was not there.
But isn't that kind of like the same way as how like the MiG fighter works, and that's been a unique unit? Like, isn't that just a basic mass-produced fighter plane that half the countries in the world use?
I'm not as familiar with the plane performance as I am with the tank performance.
There have been, like, all of the Middle Eastern countries mostly, and a lot of other countries use MiGs, so it's not surprising that you would see them across the world, but I'm not sure. I just lost my train of thought.
Like, the German tanks were legitimately better than their competitors at first. So, like, that makes sense.
Well, I don't know if the tanks themselves were, but the way they were used was... I mean,
it depends on the exact point in the war, but yeah, I would say that for chunks of time during the war, especially before the Allies adjusted, the German tanks were just better than alternative tanks. And then everyone caught up, and I would say they're no longer at a unique advantage by the end of the war.
No, because they didn't have the ability to produce stuff.
Well, that too. But also, like, people were adjusting. across the board, everyone was adjusting.
Well, but also, like, you know, the innovation in their tactics was the Blitz strategy, and they just ran out of blitz, like once they hit a quagmire, right, and it just became like actual tank warfare, they were on a much more even footing.
I think that's a little oversimplified, but I think the performance of the vehicles, like for them, justifies a unique unit that the T-34 just isn't.
Sure. I'm just saying it sounds to me a lot like a MiG, and MiGs have been unique.
Yeah, I don't know. MiGs might actually be a little better relative to other planes than the T-34 was relative to other tanks.
But
it
also depends.
And the T-34 is fine. It wasn't like completely useless or something, but
yeah.
I don't know. It was a tank.
It also depends on like just how the game works. I mean, if each civ is getting one unique unit, like I think making it the T-34 for like Russia or whatever, the Soviet Union, would be a waste. I would rather see something that's more unique and iconic. But
yeah, unless you're like separating Russia across history from the Soviet Union.
Right. But if you've
then got, like, the other Russian units are so much more obvious to use.
Yeah. But if you've got a system where, you know, every civ is getting multiple, you know, unique units, or maybe every civ has one unique unit every era or something like that, then yeah, sure. Fine.
Yeah. If you've got a bunch of them.
There was a long discussion in this thread about specific Russian history, which was interesting.
I guess you could just make it cheaper than other tanks rather than like have it be statistically better. That would be interesting. Like, it's the same as other tanks, but doesn't cost as much to produce. That would be an interesting take on a unique unit.
Wasn't that the, I think we've had units like that before. Like, I think I remember in Civ 5, the Iroquois Mohawk Warrior was basically, it was a cheaper swordsman that did not require iron, but it was like just as strong or maybe slightly weaker. It also had buffs in like forests and stuff like that, but.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't just like a sword, but cheaper. There were some other things going on there. So, like, having something be cheaper is a significant advantage if it's cheaper by enough.
Well, and also if it does not require the resource.
Yeah, I mean, depending on how you implement resources in the Civ games, that could be insane. I think Civ 6 got away from that quite a bit, or you just get infinite of your unique units.
And Civ 6, I think you doubled down on it because they made it so that you required the resource for maintenance too, right? Like, units required, you know, like iron per turn. So
yeah, only in the late game.
No, I can't. That's true.
Like, I think you need it earlier to heal your.
If you had to have one piece of each thing to be able to repair, yes.
And if you didn't have enough, I think there was also a debuff to unit strength.
Yes.
But yeah, later in the game, I think it's like infantry or something like that. It's like one oil per turn or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah, that annoyed me that that was directly competing with tanks. Because there were kind of different roles. And yeah, you needed some fuel to support infantry, but come on now.
I think we've been over that once before. It's like, why is it that? Why is it not something else?
Yeah.
I get that that's sort of representing the support vehicles in a sense, but it seemed like it was a one per turn per unit. It seemed like it was excessive. I don't know how you subdivided them to smaller, but still.
I just use artillery anyway. Just like real history. Just already spam things to death.
I see letters of mark showing up in some people's posts, so I guess other people are talking about privateers too.
It's just a fun system to mess with people too.
And that would actually be an interesting mechanic too, is maybe instead of having a dedicated privateer unit, if like letter of mark was just a promotion that you could give to any or, you know, certain types of naval units that effectively turns it into a privateer.
Oh, like it would remove the nationality flag?
Yes. But it'd be a promotion that you could give to hypothetically any naval unit.
This missile cruiser is totally not mine, guys. I don't know why you think that.
or Brazil's unique battleship. Oh, what? No, of course not.
It's a Minas Gerais.
That must have been one of the ones we sold to another nation. No idea who.
Yeah, exactly. It was a gift.
We're shocked that they're using it this way.
Let's be honest, it was probably Chile. They definitely wouldn't give it to the Argentinians.
Oh boy.
There's a long history of battleship one-upsmanship. In the South American theater, right around the time of the First World War and a little bit after. So you've got three of these countries that are arguably not in the best economic shape compared to the rest of the world, trying to build the biggest battleship against each other.
Well, I think the battleship arms race was going on you know, everywhere leading up to the First World War, you know, with like the dreadnoughts and stuff. Everyone wanted to build the biggest, bestest dreadnoughts.
A lot of tech was improving so quickly too. Like the capabilities between like pre-World War One ships and like World War II ships is insane.
Well, I mean, and you even have like Japan that, you know, recognized that the aircraft carrier was going to be the future of naval warfare, but they still built the Yamato.
Yeah.
Well, when you get
these ships fought each other, it wasn't clear like what would perform the best in those naval battles.
Can we stop giving the U.S. a unique fighter?
It's going to go
back to Minutemen.
Yeah.
It was the F-15.
Yeah.
I'd rather it go back to Minutemen, honestly.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot in between where the U.S. had stuff that was like standing out relative to the rest of the world at the time. Even the Minutemen is a bit of a stretch.
I want to say there was a game that had like the Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
Yes, CIF-4 did. But there too, like our special forces are great, but I don't know if they're like that much better than other special forces when not integrated into like the biggest military industrial complex in the world.
I could maybe see an argument for like maybe the Ironclad or a specific type of Ironclad being a American unique unit.
I don't think so.
Could do that, but I don't know.
We only built two of them, I think, but
we built one of them. The Confederates built the other.
Well, did the Confederates build it, or was it built by the United States and then just commandeered by the Confederates?
Unclear.
Because I thought it was a pre-existing U.S. naval warship that they basically, you know, captured and then renamed.
I don't think that's true, because the Confederate one was significantly less advanced and wasn't particularly good at its job.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up. I don't remember.
I would too. I'm not going to say one way or the other, but I don't
think... Either way, I don't know that like a ship prototype extends into being a unique unit that well.
Also, other countries built them and built them better, so...
Yeah. Well, that's like starting the leapfrogging of naval technology.
Well, there was a period, I want to say, during the immediate post-Civil War period where naval thought didn't really accelerate a whole lot in the U.S. It wasn't until much later that they did the Great White Fleet, which was where they really were like, oh, maybe we should build ships this way.
Yeah. Although they advanced in the rest of the world. But yeah,
The rest of the world was still actively fighting. We were just kind of sitting there.
I don't see a UU out of that.
I don't know how this would translate into a specific unique unit, but, you know, I also know that in the American Civil War, like, there were a lot of new urban fighting tactics that were, and in fact, I mean, that's been even in the Revolutionary War, like, you know, guerrilla and urban tactics were a big thing, but especially in the Civil War. And, you know, a lot of the militaries that were successful in, you know, like World War One and World War Two were the militaries that looked at what, you know, was going on in the U.S. Civil War and adapted their strategies and, you know, weren't just sending lines of riflemen, you know, out into an empty field or cavalry charging machine gun emplacements.
Yep. The Civil War and the Revolutionary War were executed remarkably similarly, but the technology made a difference. So,
yeah, like I said, I don't know how you, because that's more of a strategy tactics kind of thing. I don't know how that would necessarily translate into a unique unit.
It does.
Well, a lot of unique units were more so because of the strategy and tactics than the quality of their equipment, like amongst all of them.
But what I'm getting at is basically I could also see an argument for a U.S. Civil War era, you know, infantry that is specialized in urban warfare.
Yeah, I guess I could see that.
I just don't know what you would call that unit.
Like some like redcoat-esque era thing, but that's more
gray coat, like
guerrilla.
Well, we wouldn't want to call them that.
I'm thinking riflemen though, not musketmen. So redcoats. Well, I don't know. Redcoats.
Well, they had rifles.
Rifleman replacement. Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, this is a little bit later than that, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, like, it's probably going to be a rifle analog anyway, not like a World War II infantry.
Yeah, it wouldn't be an infantry. So unless they have like, you know, like the Great War era stuff that like the Civ 5 expansions had, maybe it could fit in there, but even that's a little later than
Civ 6 has that as well with the line infantry.
Yeah.
No, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, I guess you could do something with that if you're bringing that into Civ 7.
Maybe I'm just upset.
Let's mix it up.
Maybe I'm just upset because in Civ 5 and Civ 6, fighters are so underused.
Well, and I think a big thing is, like, I think a conscious part of their design is they want every unit in the game to have a unique replacement somewhere. So, like, what other unique planes would you put in the game other than an American unique plane or hypothetically the Soviet MiG?
The B-52 would be an excellent choice.
Sure, yeah.
It's still an American plane. But...
It's an American plane, but it's been around since the 50s, and it's not going away until the 2050s.
So you're just saying your issue is specifically with it being a fighter.
Yeah.
You're fine with a bomber.
Bombers are great. The problem with fighters is, when do you use them?
Yeah, but again,
you could make them more useful in Civ as well.
In Civ 5, the absolute worst unique unit was the Japanese Zero because fighters didn't work that way. It had a bonus to something that fighters didn't do. So maybe that's coloring my view of Civ 6, but in Civ 6, I've used bombers tons of times. I've never used a fighter.
You could have air superiority mechanics.
What about a unique German Stuka dive bomber? So it's a fighter, but can be used as a bomber.
Well, fighters generally can, I think.
That would be interesting. In the game.
You can attack land units with fighters to some effect. It's not nearly as good as bombers.
Sure, but what I'm saying is you'd have a dogfighter / interceptor fighter unit, but that is also an effective bomber. Effective as an actual bomber, but...
I think the only option you'd have for that would be either the Stuka or something like one of the American planes in the Cold War.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Even in World War II, there was lots of fighter bombers. They used the same chassis, and they would just put bombs on them as fighters and use them as close air support.
Necessity is the mother of invention, I guess.
Well, sure, but also it can carry the payload, and the payload is significant enough that it's threatening.
Yeah.
So,
actually, come to think of it, have we ever seen a unique helicopter replacement?
Oh my gosh! I don't think we have.
What would it be though?
I forgot that those units even exist in Civ.
Your only options are going to be either the Hind or the Apache, really.
Yeah.
In terms of iconic helicopters.
Yeah, I was just thinking of that because I just mentioned earlier that I think they try to make an effort to give a unique unit for every unit type that's in the game. But I'm thinking I don't think there's ever been a unique helicopter. And helicopters have been around in the game for a while. I think Civ 4 had helicopters.
Yes, and they had a specific unit type called helicopter units that only contained that unit.
Yeah.
Because I believe they were upgraded scouts.
I forget.
I don't know, but yeah,
that might be right.
They were very effective at what they did.
I thought it was a military unit, because I thought it was an anti-tank. I thought it was an anti-tank unit. So I don't know if it would have upgraded from the scout. I don't think Civ 4 had... I think Civ 4, the scout upgraded to the Explorer, and that was it.
Yeah, the scout definitely upgraded to the Explorer, but I don't remember if there's anything past that. Yeah, I don't think it was Explorer to helicopter, no. Man, I practically never used them in Civ 4, the helicopters.
I think we need to go back to having a unique worker unit. Bring back the fast worker.
We don't even give it a special name or anything. It's just the fast worker. There you go, India. All that rich history, you get the fast worker. Which, to be fair, is an excellent, unique unit.
Yeah.
Couldn't even figure out a name for it.
Yeah, they kind of mailed that one in when deciding what to give the Indian Nation.
That was really reaching for trying to create a varied, unique unit. That was a bit of a stretch. But again, in a game where every Civ has multiple unique units, I would be perfectly open to the idea of a unique civilian unit. I mean, I think we had that with, Grand Columbia, right? Had the unique generals?
Yeah.
Kind of a civilian unit?
No.
I would not think of generals as civilians.
Generals are not civilians.
Technically, in the game, I think it's considered a civilian unit.
Oh, my God.
But yeah,
so we did get unique generals.
Well, there was a certain game that had unique great generals in Civ 5.
But yeah, what about, we got any ideas for, unique writers and unique artists and unique engineers?
I think they're all unique by definition.
True. But something more along the lines of what Grand Columbia had, where some Civ gets a special line of, unique great people.
Well, Grand Columbia was kind of an outlier in that it was crazy overpowered and still is.
Well, sure.
Giving them great general uniques giving them an entire class of unique general that all have their own thing is pretty ridiculous. So I don't think that should be something we should aspire to. Do it the way they did it in Civ 5, where Mongols had unique great generals, and it was only because they had a scenario for that.
Or a unique spy unit.
That would be very unsatisfying if it's not on the map. But anyway, I think
speaking of unsatisfying,
should...
I hope we get a good espionage system.
Yeah. I think we should wrap up here. What do you think?
I think this has been episode 437 of Polycast. I'm Michael Lou, with me as usual, Canis Albinus.
I think I lost the plot.
Me and team.
I've always got a plot I can deliver.
Mega Bears fan.
Now I'm going to be thinking of weird, unique unit ideas all day.
I'm going to be chasing down Rayquazas.
Okay.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, 6, and Beyond Earth content. Copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.